Welcome to Radio Free Albion with Tony Trigilio. My guest today is Sandra Simons. Sandra's recent book is Mother Was a Tragic Girl, which was published in 2012 by the Cleveland State Poetry Center. And she's also the author of Warsaw Bikini, published by Bloof Books in 2008. Welcome to Radio Free Albion. This is Tony Trigilio, and I'm talking today via Skype with Sandra Simons. Sandra's most recent book is Mother Was a Tragic Girl, which was published by the Cleveland State University Poetry Center earlier in 2012. And she's also the author of the book of poems Warsaw Bikini, which came out with Bloof Books in 2008. Her poems have been published widely in many journals, including Poetry Magazine, The Believer, The American Poetry Review, Fence, Court Green, and many others. She lives in Tallahassee, Florida, and she's an assistant professor of English at Thomas University in Georgia. Hello, Sandra. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you. Thanks for having me on your show.
You know, as I was reading your bio right now to introduce everything, I was thinking of the first time that we talked at length in person anyway, and that was at your Myopic Books reading in Chicago a few years ago. And for those of you that don't know, Chicago Myopic is one of the best, if not the best, I think it's the best non-university reading series in the city. It's just an amazing series. And, the reading was great. And then afterwards, I went to buy a copy of Warsaw Bikini, and you just gave it to me. And then you were like giving them to anybody who asks. There's no selling. And it was so much different than the usual, you know, like, hi, I'm a poet, buy my books.
Yeah, I think I'm really bad at selling my book. Like, really unusually bad, actually. I always feel a little guilty when people buy them. So I sort of, I've given a lot of copies away. and I don't even know if I have a copy of Warsaw Bikini. I think I might have one around my house. I don't know.
Well, you know. Folks who are listening, if they don't, you know, if you don't have a copy of Warsaw Bikini, I think people should buy one on Amazon and send one to you.
Well, yeah, I think so too. considering that I've given a lot of them out for free, but the flip side of that is that a lot of times people will ask me for a copy or where they can get it, and they're basically saying, will you send me a copy? And then I end up saying yes, and then, of course, I get so busy with everything, I forget to send the copies, so that's probably not very good either. So I don't know.
I know what you mean. It's not good in terms of like publishers.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a poetry as a gift economy. And I remember saying that once to a publisher, and the guy's eyes just bugged out of his head. Like, I just swore at him. And I was like, I said to him, oh yeah, that's right. I can't really say that to you. You're a publisher.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I put a lot of poems on, like, on a blog and things like that. I enjoy that. I don't know. I guess I like the immediate sense that, like, maybe a few people would read the poem, 10 or something like that, but not a huge number. So I don't know. I have a weird relationship to poems being in the world and how they go out into the world and how they come back and haunt you, I guess.
Yeah, and they go out into the world in so many different ways now, and they can haunt us in so many more different ways than even 5 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's strange. You know, I put this poem on my blog, and then someone linked it on Twitter, and then someone else linked it and said the person who linked it wrote it, and she wouldn't change that. She just wouldn't do it. And it really bothered the person who linked the poem. And it didn't bother me that much, actually, but it's very strange. I mean, the internet has really changed the landscape, I think, in some way, well, in some major way. I don't know.
I know, and I think it's sometimes like when I when I think of like what you said earlier about how I'm not really good with selling books, and I feel kind of funny sometimes when I sell books. I always did too a little bit, and then you know the internet changed that too when I did a chapbook with a press that was just given away for free, and that got so many more readers than books that cost money.
I know. I sort of hope that I can just put my book online at some point. I think that would actually, I would like that. I don't know. I mean, I like the book object as well, but I think it's after a couple years, I don't see why it wouldn't just be online, really. I don't know.
I'd always like to have both myself. I know. The object, it's hard for me to walk away from the book as an object, the way it smells and the way it looks, and you know, someone who publishes an oversized book as opposed to like those little Hanuman editions. I mean, they're all the object itself is great, I think.
Absolutely. And I like making books too, and you know, if I have the time. I'm still friends with her, an art professor at FSU, and she's into bookmaking, and she taught me how to make books. And I love doing that kind of thing where I make one copy of you know, a book with a few poems in it and just sending it to a friend. I've done that many times, and I find it very gratifying, just the object, the book object. So, yeah.
And I feel the same way as someone who doesn't make books but loves, you know, handmade books. When I see one, when I see an art book like that or an artist book, I think, oh, you know, people are making the paper, they're making the books, they're learning how to bind them. You know, books are a niche thing maybe, but they're not obsolete yet. They can still have a presence as an object in our lives. You know, I was thinking about when we were talking about buying books and how funny it feels. You know, when I got Warsaw Bikini from you at Myopic, it also felt really I wasn't angling to get it for free, so don't get me wrong, but it felt kind of appropriate that it was given away, because your poems are so, you know, so often political, and you know, I want to talk a little bit about politics and maybe class also.
Okay.
One of the things I'm really struck by in your work is that you're political, and it's a real smart kind of politics. Like, you know, a lot of times, you know, poetry that's political, and this is just my temperament, my biases, you know, sometimes it can be kind of muddy-headed, poetry can solve this political problem, and it's always an effort to evade the fact that I think, you know, politics is always about conflict, and I feel that the conflict is in your work, and it's also very subtle the way you're working with poetry, and you know, all kinds of aspects of politics, feminism, motherhood, and also, you know, economic class issues.
Well, they're really, I mean, those are the things that I care about, and that's, so therefore that's what I write about. I mean, I think that, you know, I think we should reject this idea that all poems are political or something like that. I don't believe that. I reject that pretty much, or that all people are political. I think there's some sort of effort that has to take place in thinking about those things. On the other hand, I think that there's, you know, poets can be very interior and sort of shying away from the world in some sense. You know, I mean, there's a conflict between political action, I think, and also, at least in my experience, the temperament of a poet.
Yeah.
So that's always difficult, you know. But I've done a lot of, you know, I started the graduate student or graduate employee union at FSU when I was a graduate student, and so I've done a lot of political work my entire life. I don't know exactly why it's been so important to me, but it really has. And of course, my poems are a reflection, you know, and some basic level of what I do in my life. So I think of myself in some way as sort of, you know, thinking about reality and material reality. So class, of course, is very important. Motherhood, but a specific kind of motherhood, you know, for me, someone working and not having any time, and how sad it is on some level that, you know, American, well, at least in my case, women don't have the time to spend with their children, working, doing everything. There just doesn't seem to be any time available. So that's, of course, a struggle for me now, but also, like, I don't work at a school that has a union. So I have, I feel very, in some sense, a little bit powerless to change those circumstances. So those are the things that I think about a lot in my poems. Those are the things that I'm concerned about. Money, class, work. I don't know why they're such complete obsessions. I don't know. Maybe it's what they are. Maybe it's because what's in front of me.
I think that's maybe, you know, I when I think of those like the role class plays in my work, it's there in front of me all the time. It's there in my background. It's something I'm probably a lifelong process of something I'm trying to work out. And the issues you're raising, they sound like, you know, when they go back to, you know, starting the graduate student union, and I'm sure to life events before that too. It just sounds like these are things that are part of the lifelong art project that is your life.
Yeah, I mean, I've always, even for, I have this journal from when I was a little kid, and poverty or inequality has just always, I mean, it's so funny because there's this one part in this little journal, I say, I want to be rich because I want to be happy, but I really don't want anyone to be poor in the world. So I don't know, there's just this, I just think it's part of who I am. Of course, I grew up in Los Angeles, and, you know, my mother raised me in a single parent home, so that probably has something to do with it. There was a lot of struggle, economic struggle. So that my awareness, I had, you know, some kind of class consciousness very, very early. And it just never left, I think. And I don't think I've ever aspired to actually change that. Like, I live in a very small apartment. I don't have a washer and a dryer. I don't have a dishwasher. My friends are sort of horrified that how many people can live in this house. And Josh, I don't know. I have a strange relationship to material.
I'm thinking of when we're talking about your small apartment and your strange relationship to material objects and material goods and money and wanting to, you know, wanting nobody to be poor. And at the same time, which makes perfect sense to me. I see exactly what you're saying. And then I'm also like, well, we're talking about poetry, and people are always telling me, well, poetry is an elite art form. And I look back historically, our practitioners in the art were often, you know, royalty, because they had the time and the money to do something like that. And I think that, you know, maybe in the 20th and 21st centuries, part of the reason that we have such, you know, we can have such class consciousness in poetry is that a lot of us who weren't brought up with unreal kinds of privilege were turned on to the art form anyway, and trying to negotiate that.
I mean, I think it's absolutely ridiculous that I'm a poet. Like, I should, you know, I should have been aspired to, you know, to be an accountant or something like that. It's very strange, but I also think that it's important. I mean, and not in some like crass or vulgar, like, oh, we have to write reality and, like, you know, some kind of, you know, I can think of, I'm not going to name names, but, you know, a million conservative anti-intellectual writers who, you know, who have that sort of idea, you know, poetry is not of the academy and we should be writing about, you know, McDonald's or something. Mm-hmm, like that. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with that. I reject that. But at the same time, I think it is important that we poets should be writing about their about material reality, you know what I mean? Not just some you know, some kind of fantasy, or political reality. I think it's really important, and I don't think enough are doing it.
No, I don't think so either. When I bring up the subject of political poetry, most of the responses I get, I feel like I'm having a discussion about like Soviet socialist realism, you know, like you have to write the one kind of political poem. And I'm like, well, there's nothing subtle in that. And it doesn't really intersect my daily life very much. But then, you know what I mean? And then there's like, I'll read, you'll have a poem about going to yoga class. And you're not just going to yoga class. There's all these kinds of, there's this roiling, simmering politics of what it means to be, you know, a woman in the early 21st century, a mother, going to yoga class. And that's, there's something political there. It doesn't, for another writer, it might not be, but what I like is that for you, it is political.
Well, I think I've kept myself, this may be really a weird thing, but I've kept myself from, in my material life, from doing what you're supposed to do, which is get more and be and accumulate wealth and try to, I don't do that. And I think that that's probably part of it, part of my way that I function as a writer. And I like that on some level. But I also think that, I don't want anyone to tell me, oh, you have to write political poems. Like, I reject that completely. Like, you know, and I think most writers do. No one wants to be told what to write. But, you know, I think as my friend Anne says, you know, you write what you need on some level. You know, you need to write. And it's very hard for me to write because I don't have a lot of time. Like right now, even talking to you, I'm thinking in the back of my head, okay, my kids are going to come home in this amount of time, right?
Right, like, exactly.
That's what I have to do. So that's my reality. But also, all of the struggles that we face as workers, I mean, that's a global thing. It's not just me. Obviously, I don't want everything to be made out like this is me, but I have to base my writing in my experiences, my particular experiences. Otherwise, they won't feel, you know, genuine to me. And so therefore, I don't think that anyone can relate to it. So I think that's an important aspect. I hope I'm not speaking in complete cliches.
No, you're not. You're not. And I can understand why you'd be worried about that, because every time I talk about political poetry and like 5 minutes ago when I was asking you a question, I was worried I was speaking in cliches because it's just so hard to, we're faced with, you know, in my opinion, mostly bad poems that are politically oriented in some way. And it's rare when I get really excited about a poet's, you know, political impulses or an individual political poem. And what you're saying is really, you're describing like the process that, you know, where I get excited by it, where I'm relating to the poet's individual situation. I don't feel like I'm being told how to read or I'm being told how to write. I feel like I'm getting into a window into one person and their historical context and their personal context, and that gets made political in the poem. And then I'm drawn in and I don't want to leave, you know?
I agree. And I think, there's a of course a backlash against political poetry. I do feel like when people start writing political poetry, everyone sort of is like, oh, that's bad or something like that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Do that. You know, it's fine to write about your cat. You know, no, hundreds of poems about, you know, this or that, but you know, you write about some political theme, or and that's, I think, what people don't like, is like that there be a theme. And I understand that, you know, I agree. I think that no one wants to feel like that is forced. And I think we all know the limitations, like, okay, the poem's probably not going to, you know, have some huge real world political impact. I mean, look at this guy that, you know, just got a life sentence in Qatar. You know, he got a life sentence for a basically a poem that he wrote. So, I mean, in a weird way, it's like it didn't even really. He could have probably written any number of things and have gotten the same life sentence. So I don't know what is the power. I imagine, right? He could have written that poem and then 20 other versions of it. It's not like the one thing that he said. It was what he was saying. You know, the idea of what he was saying. Mm-hmm. So I guess I don't know. There's in some places poetry really does have a different kind of political power.
And it's right? I'm really glad that we're going in this direction too, because I, you know, as we were talking about the political poem, and I was worried about falling into cliches. There was also in the back of my mind, I was like, well, you know, the things we're talking about in the political poem are unique to, you know, North Americans and our sense of where we are and our sense of what the privileges that we have. And part of the, you know, nobody reads poetry, but that also means we can say a lot of things we might normally not say, not be able to say in other art forms. But man, in other countries, that freedom isn't there. So the poem itself, the act of writing the poem takes on, I know what you mean, a much more political tenor just to be writing it, let alone.
I mean, can you even imagine? You write a poem and you end up in jail, a life sentence in jail. It's unbelievable.
Oh, it's stunning. Like I'm thinking, you write a poem and you think, I hope some people will read it. You know,
right.
Maybe someone's going to email you and say, that's a really cool poem. It really moved me. Or a prosecutor comes and puts you in jail for life. It's unfathomable. I know.
It's crazy. It's absolutely, but that's the kind of, I mean, that is part of our world. You know, we can't just ignore it.
Can't pretend it's not there. No. Yeah.
Well, and that's what makes it so hard to write poetry. I mean, at least for me, and this is personal, and I don't speak for anyone else, but that's why it's almost so difficult to write, you know? When I see something like that or I hear something like that, I'm embarrassed. I really am. I'm embarrassed about writing, and I'm embarrassed about writing about myself because I feel sort of, you know, useless, hopeless, and embarrassed. Like, I really don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I feel embarrassed because I feel like, well, what gives me the right to write about this or that when this can happen, you know?
Oh, completely, especially when you say, like, it makes you embarrassed to write about yourself. That's what really, okay. When I hear stories like that, I'm like, well, no matter what... No matter what crazy shit's going on in my life or in my head that I think I need to write about, and I know I can write about it in a way that doesn't sound like a, you know, I'm reaching for a punchline at the end of the poem or something. It's like, it doesn't compare to someone who's suffering in solitary confinement in Qatar.
I know. And then you have, but there has to be some room for like light and humor and things like that. Otherwise, you know, I don't know.
As a teacher once said to me about my poems, like, well, when you write this kind of poem, you know, you don't want every poem to be buzzing with anger. And he said, you need to bring light into the poem without being a light verse poet. And I thought that was a real challenge, but I got it. You know, when I started to find poetry that made me laugh, I got it.
Well, that's part of the, you know, experience too, is that, you know, like laughter and jokes. Oh my God, can you imagine a world without that? It would be horrible. So yeah, and a lot of people just only write these very serious poems. So it is nice. I was fortunate at FSU that my teachers were, they're real, their poems have David Kirby and Harry Hamby. They're not political at all. I mean, they don't, they do not, I don't mean that as an insult. That's just not what they do, but, you know. But they're really funny, and I think I learned something from them, just kind of having a little bit of lightness.
Yeah, it's not something we're always taught in extreme circles about what a poem can do. You need to find that from a practicing poet of laughter. Yeah.
True.
So, you know, I'm thinking, this would be a good spot to hear a poem. We've talked a lot about, you know, politics in your poetry and laughter in your poetry and the everyday aspects of politics and laughter in your poetry. But let's hear something, and it can be related to what we've been talking about or totally different, you know, whatever you want.
Okay. Well, I've written, I feel like this is a really, this is an interesting interview because I picked out poems that are not terribly political. They're actually, well, I mean, I suppose the first one is I just had a baby about 5.5 months ago, and I got little girl, and I got I had a postpartum hemorrhage, so I really almost died. It was very horrible.
My God.
I know. And I had all these blood transfusions, stuff like that. But I wrote a series of poems based on them. And I don't know what to call them. My friends that I meet for poetry groups think that first it was like postpartum hemorrhage poem 1, 2. And they were like, no, don't do that. So I don't have titles yet, but I'll read this first one. This one's not published. The other one's going to be in the Boston Review in April. So, okay, I'll read this for some. I know I should be thankful to be alive, but all I can think about is soup, specifically the cabbage soup diet that my sister went on in 9th grade, and my mother, who agreed to cook it for her because my sister was a little chubby, which in Los Angeles is huge. So for a month, the apartment smelled like some back alley in Budapest, and coming home made me more nauseated than ever. But when a massive amount of diuretic spilled out of the front pocket of my sister's JanSport backpack one day after school, my mother flipped out and cabbage was henceforth banned. While my sister dabbled in weight loss, I was the real pro, the bona fide anorexic, the one whose body said, I have become your problem, to whomever saw me. The one who could make a saltine last a week, a sweet tart a month, creating a grotesquerie of base that my poor sister could not rival. The martyr, the saint, the devil, the havoc, the teen, reckless, haunted, disheveled as trees or shovelfuls of grown dirt. A grave, a sea, a torn up seed, in love with nothing but her own terror, a body made of cold black jade, all destined for the next life, all Dante on the river Styx with no Beatrice, no place to warm your hands. So when I almost died after giving birth to you, Charlotte, I could remember what it was like, the ecstatic, crisp blood, the river feel of a return to order.
That was Sandra Simons reading from New Work. And you don't have a title yet for the project? You're calling it Postpartum
Hemorrhage poems. I also thought of the natural history of blood, but my friends rejected that completely. So I don't know.
So it's not the natural history of blood, but maybe postpartum hemorrhage poems.
I don't know. What do you think? I don't know.
So, I kind of like the natural history of blood. Because you get the sort of stock phrase, the natural history of blank, and yeah. I don't expect blood to follow. And then if it does, my first thought isn't going to be postpartum hemorrhage. So then if it is that, I think that'd be I'd be in the poem right away, you know?
Well, I'll think about it.
Okay. Yeah. that was a great poem, and it got me thinking of, the way you move from this beginning, I should be thankful to be alive, to this craving for soup, to like, then we get the devil, the river Styx, Dante, your child, Charlotte is her name, right?
Yeah.
And then Charlotte, Dante to Charlotte. You just have this in your work. You have this really incredible way of being able to take the reader in almost whiplash in so many different directions. If it weren't done well, we'd get whiplash. But the way you do it, I feel like we'll follow you anywhere. You know, like okay, we're going to start with you should be thankful to be alive. We're going to go to the soup, and oh yeah, of course we're in the River Styx now. But that's where we should be in this poem. And I love the way you do that. And it's just, it works really well in your poems.
Thank you. I don't know who, how did I learn that? I think I learned something from Frank O'Hara when it comes to leaping around, and also Lorca does a lot of that, these leaps. So I think that's something that I learned just from reading and thinking like, oh, I want to do that. That's really cool. And Jory Graham came to the University of Montana when I was an graduate student. And she came for like a day or something like that. And she talked about how the reader will follow you anywhere imaginatively, but you have to give them enough to go on. And I think that that's very true. Like if you, the reader, you can never underestimate the imaginative power that a reader has. But the problem is, and I'm totally guilty of this. Sometimes you don't provide enough of like the bridge, and so the reader gets lost. But if you provide enough, you know, you can really take someone really, really far, which is, of course, one of the absolute beautiful things about poetry. So it's a challenge, but I do enjoy it. I like that. I like to get to the, if I can, to like the most transcendental place, and so like Los Angeles, you know, I don't know, hippie weirdo. But I like that.
Oh yeah. No, it's, and O'Hara for me, of the examples you mentioned, O'Hara for me really sticks out in that way. Like he makes me care where the poem is going to go, whether it ends up, you know, in a movie theater or on the moon or something, you know.
Right.
And it's like, and it's hard because when you're doing that, you need to assume, I know you need to assume the reader is a careful enough reader to follow and care about where I'm going to go. And then you have to assume that you can make the bridge and it'll happen. It's just going to happen unconsciously most of the time, I think, for me anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, and it's fun. Like I like that. I think that's one of my favorite aspects of poetry is this journey where you don't know where you're going to end up and you don't know where you are and you're lost. And then you find yourself. I mean, what, it's beautiful. There's, I love that. So.
Yeah. And this is where I think we're lucky to not have a huge readership because, you know, if we had to run our poems through focus groups like Hollywood movies, they'd all be like, well, I don't know. I mean, one minute I'm in Los Angeles and the next minute I'm in the River Styx and I don't know. That's just, you know, I wanted to check my phone after that or something, you know, it's like, I don't want a focus group. You know, I want someone who cares about that and wants to go from LA to, you know, a mythological place of the underworld.
Lately like that because I've been doing more readings than I ever did before and I'm not like the best I'm not the best reader but I've noticed that it seems to me that the performance of poetry is really coming back into to be it seems that and maybe it's just the readings that I'm going to but people seem to be really interested in the performance aspect of poetry that I haven't seen in since I started writing. Like when I went to readings as an undergraduate, I would be a great poet would come and I would just be really bored because the reading would just be so horrible and boring. And I don't know. I just feel I don't know if you've noticed that or not. I don't know what it is, but
I've been noticing it more with the folks who come through Columbia College. And by the way, Sandra's going to be reading at Columbia College on February, I think it's 13th, the second Wednesday in February, with Joseph Harrington. That was an unintentional plug for your reading, but perfect. but as people have been coming through, like maybe 7 or 8 years ago, you would sometimes get, you know, maybe a very cerebral poet who would be like, okay, I've got to be behind the podium. I've got to be very, you know, kind of stiff with the right posture. And I have to read in that serious voice. But now you can get a playful, even these labels, the playful poet, the cerebral poet, I think they're all kind of intermingling. And we're getting more poets who know that, you know, my words are going to connect with the audience, but I need to, as a person, connect with them too.
I know. For me, it puts this tremendous pressure.
Yeah,
like,
it does.
Because I mean, people think I'm really, really outgoing. And the truth is like, I'm like the most, I'm really just a very internal person. So when I go and do these things, it's really, I mean, it takes everything out of me. And it puts this pressure, like now I have to be really entertaining. It's really hard. I don't know.
I don't think like I know exactly what you're saying. Like if I do a reading that goes really well, it probably looks like all I wanted to do was read that night and I knew the poems and I knew they were going to work and I was like Mr. Confidence, but no one would know that 15 minutes before the reading, I was like, oh man, why am I doing this? And
I know.
I could be writing at home by myself.
Yeah, I know. Truthfully, I mean, yeah, That's exactly how I feel. And I read a lot because my friends are all really, especially the blues poets like Jennifer Knox and Peter Davis. Like they're like entertainers. So when I read with them, I just feel like completely out of my element. But it's fun. I love listening to them and stuff like that. But,
and that kind of helps me with the readings too. Like I love. Like Peter, for example, as I've seen him read and how entertaining he is. And I'm like, okay, you know, I really do enjoy this. And like, I got this connection with him when I heard him read, and I can make a connection too, even though deep at the core, this person standing up, this, you know, this me that's standing up in front of people reading is unbelievably shy and can't believe he's in front of people reading this, what he wrote by himself in his office. You know, it's,
I know.
And I think we're all that way. We just don't even, it's just, it's very, we know they're important, the readings, but most of us, I think we spend so much time alone reading. We're kind of isolated people. Yeah.
We are. And there's this like, you know, Facebook and Twitter and all over the place, sort of, I don't know, weird forced social aspect to our world. I mean, I love it because it's fun to, you know, talk to people and things like that.
Let's hear another poem, and it can be from, anything, again, from the new project or anything you want.
Yeah, I'll read this poem. It's from the new project. We'll just call it The Natural History of Blood.
Okay.
Okay, losing so much blood is like the moment before an old woman closes the shiny red window shutters of her little apartment in Chamonix, glancing up at the melting snow where the bighorn sheep make their way down steep rock faces, and she thinks for an instant of the angels that gather around a dead mouse, and then immediately returns to her chair where she works on a crossword puzzle, the word coffers, the clue, quote, let me see what's in the household blank, and I'll get back to you about making a donation, end quote. All in French, of course, while outside the apartment, birds carry sticks to their nests. And right around here is where my sister and I went hiking in our 20s. And suddenly, on the trail between two mountain huts, I had a panic attack, what in another century would have been called dread, as if my body was preparing me for all the mundane aches of what was to come, the Legos I would step on and in a rage hop on my one good foot to turn off the bathwater where my son played with his plastic trains. Trains in my family have always meant doom. Mountains, the promise of something. The sea, the intermediary between the old way of thinking and the new. Sometimes when I wake up, a voice in my head, like some 1950s commercial for Naval Oranges, says, come to California, which reminds me of how in college my friend and I would smoke marijuana out of a hollow green apple and walk around Venice Beach searching for the perfect pair of sunglasses. And for hours we'd watch the bodybuilders who seemed composed of the twisting musculature of the sun, our spirits pointed towards the golden life, weightless and ahead of us.
That was Sandra Simons reading from her new project, which could be The Natural History of Blood or Postpartum Hemorrhaging Poems, but they're whatever they're called, they're very powerful, and I'm still seeing angels gathered around a dead mouse. It's amazing.
You have a good memory.
Yeah, it just really stuck there. You've been listening to Sandra Simons today on Radio Free Albion. Her most recent book is Mother Was a Tragic Girl from Cleveland State University Poetry Center, which came out earlier in 2012 and is available at the usual online spots, including independent websites like Small Press Distribution, and at bookstores that we hope carry books of poetry from independent presses. Is there a place readers can find you online, like a website or your Twitter page or anything?
You know, I didn't pay for my website domain. I'm really bad with technology, like the domain name to be renewed. So now it's a commercial for acne medication.
Oh no.
which is like some like weird conceptual poem in itself. But I have a Tumblr at sandrasimons.tumblr.com. So if you go there, that's I don't have any links or anything, but I just put the poems I'm writing and things like that on there.
Oh, that's great. So to find Sandra online, sandrasimons.tumblr.com.
Correct.
And so go there. Don't go to her other site unless you want advice on acne medication. And
I'm so bad at these things. It's ridiculous.
at least something weird like this acne medication came out of it, though. Well, thanks again, Sandra. It's been great talking with you.
Tony, thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Albion. If you're a poet and you'd like to be on a future show, or if you just want to email me and tell me what you thought of today's show, you can get in touch with me at Radio Free Albion, that's one word, radiofreealbion@gmail.com. You can also go to the show's Twitter page, twitter.com/radiofreealbion. Thanks again for listening.